It is truly, it is incalculable how powerful it is to, like, it's 8, 9, maybe 10, and you've knocked out the most important thing you wanted to do that day.
Yeah, that's amazing. That you must just feel on top of the world for the rest of the day. Totally. Yeah.
House money after that. Do you hear that? That's my brain huffing and puffing after the workout it just went through with the voicemails we got from callers. Woo! This episode is a, it is, well, for me and AJ, it was a workout. But for you all, it should be, hopefully, answers to some of the biggest questions that are being asked right now around things like what is happening in the tech sector in the midst of a lot of economic shifts that are seemingly happening around the world, to biggest piece of advice that has grown in importance year over year that we have received as creators, as entrepreneurs, founders. A whole lot of great topics that we cover, as well as we rounded off with things that no one's discussing, but at least that we haven't personally heard anyone discuss, that we find, well, we think is something that should be discussed, and topics that are likely tectonic shifts within the tech sector that should get a little more pub. So if you have a question, hit us up, 424-272-6640. It's 424-272-6640 for the hotline, and we would love to answer your questions. But without further delay, let's get into it with today's questions. This is Below the Line. Should we get rolling?
Let's get rolling. Let's get rolling. It's good to be back. Thank you for having me. Appreciate
it. It's good to have you back. Yeah. And I hope this is the worst episode I ever do.
That would be all uphill from here then, huh?
Ball, don't lie. I want to reset the expectations. If you're listening to this, I pray to God this is the worst episode of Below the Line or worst podcast episode that you've ever heard.
Well, this is my LeBron 50 points episode, so.
Oh, shit.
Ball, don't lie.
Ball, don't lie. Indeed. Indeed. If I heard you correctly, ball, don't lie. Indeed. All right.
We're hearing from the people that we don't disagree enough on some of these. So,
that's right.
Yeah, let's make this confrontational.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, fuck you. Right off the bat. And cheers. You've got some Spindrift business. I've got a Waterloo pineapple. So we're keeping it clean in the afternoon. No caffeine, keeping it clean in the afternoon. You know what I mean? Now, I got a question for you before we get into voicemails. Question for you. What has been the scariest professional moment in your life in the last 3 months?
Ooh.
It could be an oh shit moment. It could be just the wall is closing in, but I want to hear the truly scariest moment in the last three months.
That kind of narrows it a little bit, which is good, I think. So I run a business. One of the businesses I run is a direct-to-consumer business. We sell products like candles, like books.
Massive business.
We sell them online, and we advertise on TV. And so probably the scariest moment maybe a month and a half ago, it was kind of right around, mid-late February, we just saw our direct traffic and our traffic from Google and stuff just start to, like, take a pretty serious dip. And unclear as to exactly why, because a lot of the other channels we advertise on, Facebook, et cetera, there's a lot of instrumentation around being able to understand what's driving what traffic, and we have, like, a lot of sophisticated analytics around that. But it was just, like, a general, like, direct traffic to our site and traffic coming in from people searching about our product, et cetera, just kind of went down. And there was no my usual explanation for that would have been something changing in our TV spend, because that's kind of the somewhat indirect, not super clearly attributed way that would happen. Mm-hmm. But we kept our spend relatively steady. Nothing really changed there. The TV spend looked like it was performing about the same from the kind of modeling that we have there. And honestly, still not entirely sure what happened, but I think there has been this general slowdown, as talking to more other founders who run similar companies, there has this been general slowdown around consumer spending. And I think some of it is attributed to Ukraine and the kind of crisis happening over there.
Gas prices,
maybe just general inflation, fears about inflation. People are just, like, sitting on their money a little bit. And so even just, like, the general hum that our business runs on, which is like consumers wanting to go out and buy gifts and for themselves and their friends and family and all that, buy cool products, might just not be doing that well right now, which is something that's going to impact businesses like us for sure directly, but it's going to have an indirect waterfall effect on everything, right? So I would say that is concerning also because there's a ton of ways you can adapt your business to maybe that sort of reality, but it's also totally not the kind of thing that you can control. If consumer spending is a little frightened, if people are worried about inflation, if you, people are worried about Ukraine, it's a scary world. So that's been the main one. Yeah.
Is it still in that inconclusive state, or is it, did you recover? Did your emotional state recover?
My emotional state recovered once I was able to somewhat externalize and feel like this isn't a core problem with our business. It actually might be something that people are seeing across the board. So that helped me contextualize and reframe that into like, hey, this isn't like, you know, terribly bad just for us. It's sort of terribly bad across the board. I do feel like we're living through crazy times right now. And there's this weird, more so than it's ever been in my business career, my life, my work career. There is this feeling that like, we're all sort of like winning together or like not. Like, I feel like when times are good, some people are like winning at a crazy level and some people are winning at like a medium level and a lower level. But it's like, it's based on your own ability to execute the ideas you come up with, the team you surround yourself with, et cetera. It feels like right now we're in this weird thing where like everybody is doing really well and then everybody's doing really badly. Like, general stock prices, especially in tech, right, are swinging way up and they're swinging way down.
We got a question about that later on.
Oh, okay, yeah. Perfect.
Keep going.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it feels like we're all in some of this stuff in a little bit more together of a way. Like, if inflation is going to impact everyone that holds a U.S. dollar, not you or me independently or differently, right? So I don't know. There's that makes me feel better and less emotionally kind of impacted by changes that might be happening.
Does mean the swings could be wildly more aggressive.
Yeah.
If it's all happening together.
It does feel that way. Yeah. Does that ring true for you?
Well, to spend a little bit of time on that major, that's a major observation for what's going on. And that 2 years ago, you would have, it's like having, five kids and some are scoring straight A's, some aren't making the football team, some are going through a really tough teenage stage, and one's just got into a college they want to go to. So you have this diversified love.
Basketball, yeah, you know, ball don't lie,
exactly, ball, which we've established.
Mm-hmm.
Ball don't lie, and that, I think, you just have a diversified, you have almost have a portfolio theory of mind. When you've got five things going in different directions, good, bad. But then when everything is like, oh, wow, there's potential war in our backyard, all five, it is just it's a completely different scenario psychologically. It's really, really sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad when it's like, okay, we're all potentially in harm's way,
shipping off to war, or being impacted psychologically by a similar thing,
right? And there's no way to out of it. It's just, this is
that's true. I didn't think about it as being sad, but it kind of is, right? It just, I felt it as different, but it is sort of reflects a narrowing of the options that are out there, right?
Right. Well, in like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, like the housing market, for example. All right, this industry isn't doing as well as in Dallas, for example,
where right?
I have. A lot of, we also have a lot of listeners, but a lot of friends and family growing up in Texas.
Sure.
And you have, I don't know, oil and gas is hitting the skids, but then you have a bunch of headquarters, you know, basically setting up shop in Dallas. So if you're selling homes, it's like you got those five kids and some are doing better, some are doing worse. But if you're selling homes in Dallas and everybody's dealing with inflation, everybody's coming out of basically a resetting central event of COVID, where everyone's kind of hitting the starting line at the same time, in many ways of the world opening back up. Yeah, it is scary when we're all impacted the exact same time and there is no balance of some doing well, some doing poorly. I mean, that was the state of 1929 and the beginning of what became the Great Depression. But that also was off of 7 years of incredible boom cycle.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
That is a weird, that's a weird observation. That's, I hadn't thought about it in that sense of
it
like,
it feels everybody. That way, right? It, to me, at least, it's been feeling that way where, yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's also one of those things that's easier to perceive on the way down than it is on the way up, right? So things like consumer spending slowing, inflation out of control, tech stocks down 20 to 50%, right? Those are things that like we all feel together and we feel the hurt together. When all those things are going up, I think like if it, especially if it happens over a more prolonged period, it maybe feels less like we're all in this great gain thing together.
Oh yeah, it feels like, you know, I paid my dues.
Yeah,
I got my bruises along the way. And finally, it's all coming together.
Yeah, it does when like, you know, say crypto is just like cruising and is up 20% in a week. Everyone does feel like, oh my god, have you seen the price of Bitcoin? Like, let's go, amazing. But I don't know. There's some different inflection to it where it's also like global events might be causing something. Inflation is something that literally is going to impact all of us at the same time, as opposed to even like tracking unemployment or something, which does impact like a smaller slice of the population. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it honestly could be a really healthy thing. Something that, and we actually, one of our questions, it was the tweet question. Let me read it.
Yeah, let's get it.
Actually, this is a great segue into it. But we got two voicemails that I want to listen to, and then a tweet. Sam H. Sawyer says, what do you think about the recent trends in tech stocks being down? Do you think tech is heading for a bear market? How do you think the economic shifts that are happening more wide? Sam, we'll work on that. More wide will impact tech. So he's asking, thank you for the question, Sam. And he's asking specifically a tech, but I think this is a broader observation for being an investor in early stage technology companies for the last 10 years, you building us both building companies, oftentimes together for the last 10 years. It's one of the things that I have thought a lot about when people have been saying, using phrases like, oh, we're in the seventh inning of the cycle. Since like 2015, 2016, I would hear like private equity people use that lingo.
It's really easy to tell when the sixth switches to the seventh inning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Dude, I remember it. So I was like, when I heard that, and then I heard it like the third time, I was like, who's saying this? And where are they all getting
Where are they all these? Getting seven from? Yeah, that's exactly what I want to know.
It's just such a lame way of saying like, I feel like we're near the end of the cycle. And that observation largely is made because if you look at Ray Dalio's view of economic cycles, it's the video, the explainer, which is tens of millions of views.
Yep.
Starts with the typical economic cycle, 7 to 10 years. So it starts with this premise that is the typical cycle of 7 to 10 years. Doesn't say why. 7 to 10 years. It's a brilliant explainer of why things shift up and down, but it doesn't say why 7 to 10 years. It's just this given because it's historically happened 7 to 10 years since about the 40s. But one, that's a pretty large variance between 7 and 10. It's nearly 40%, you know, difference. But also, the thing that I've thought a lot about is when we had the dot-com bust. 2000, 2001. And then we had 2007, 6 years later, 2007 and 2008, Great Recession. I feel like those were such massive shocks all within a decade that it made people much wiser than ever before, much more timid than ever before because they're like, holy shit. I remember in 2010, I don't know if you remember this, but 2010, 2011, there was this talk of like, there's going to be a double dip. A lot of people think there's going to be a double dip. 4 years later, we're still thinking like, hey, this might dip again. It's right around the corner. That gun shyness, I think, produced a really healthy economic view of, whoa, these shocks come every few years and I better brace myself for them. And that's, you know, Main Street saying that, not just Wall Street. You also had Main Street investors more hyper-connected than ever with the internet. That just didn't exist in 1992. Connected retail investors that didn't exist in 1999 even. And so this hyper connectivity, I think, also added an education. So you have this timidity that didn't necessarily exist before because of two massive shocks. Then you have this education and awareness that didn't exist before, where you have Main Street investors Sorry for the rant, but I've thought a lot about this, never actually talked about But it's, you have this Main Street investor in 2014, 2015 using strategies that Buffett is talking about.
Sure. Yeah.
In ways that just they weren't doing in 1996, right. 97.
Which is incredible. And part of that really is the knowledge of the internet as well, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. And so I think that you see this timidity and gun shyness, you see this awareness and education around retail investing and investing in general that didn't exist 20 years prior or during those cycles where it was 7 to 10 years. And then you have this hyper connectivity for, you could call it mob movement, but very quick swings.
Yep.
And this would be the top percentile of investors that maybe control the whales.
Sure.
On Wall Street,
or like controlling order flow or something like that. Yeah.
And they're even more connected themselves. So not just retail investors, but actual Wall Street, hyper connected. And that meant that whatever opportunities would come across, they would be seized faster than ever because of their own hyper connection.
Sure.
Wall Street.
Sort of like efficient markets hypothesis stuff, which has been a hypothesis for a while. Yeah.
Right. And so all of this comes down to this phrase. And it was actually in a conversation with Naval Ravikant that said this maybe 3 years ago. And he said something it was kind of offhand, but he said, I wonder if we're going to have typical cycles anymore or if we're just going to have micro recessions. Really quick downward swings and really quick recoveries. And he said that maybe 2017. This is after 2016. Beginning of 2016, we had one of those. I don't know if you remember, but tech is when LinkedIn dropped, I think 70% in 6 weeks.
Okay.
And a lot of tech stocks dropped very quickly. And then they recovered really quickly. And it ends up being a blip. 2020 and COVID ends up being a blip. And yet you look at the graph, incredible swing, a micro recession.
Insane swing. Yeah.
And so those three things, conditions, I think that hyperconnectivity, the gun shyness and then
could be happening now, right?
Right.
I mean, it's literally, yeah.
Yeah. So I wonder if in 8 weeks we've recovered. And it seems silly because we don't have much to map it to, but I wonder if 8 weeks we recover and we say, whoa, that was a 4 month micro recession.
I think the thing that I would want to overlay on that is I wonder if you're attributing almost too much knowledge also to the everyday investor. So I wonder, like, I would hope to see, you'd see all the, you know, graphs of what happened in the 2008 financial crisis. And it's so sad because you see kind of investor behavior, especially like public markets, retail investor behavior mapped on top of those swings in price. And it's just so sad. You see most people as things are going down, they sell out and then they don't buy back in. As things start to turn around and come up, they don't buy back in until, you know, basically destroying a lot of their own value until prices are higher again than maybe where they sold out at. Right. I think people have an emotional tendency to sell when things are low, unfortunately, because there's the whole mindset of you don't want to catch this falling dagger. You know, you're not going to. It's so funny. I see this play out. I've seen it play out even just over the past few months with all of tech stocks taking a massive hit. People were looking for back in October, November, looking at stocks like Shopify or Square or Airbnb, amazing tech stocks, amazing tech companies, and saying, I really want to buy some of this. It seems like a little too pricey right now, but I really want to. I like believe in this company. I want to invest in this company. And then some of these stocks are hit 40, 50%, literally, right? I think Shopify, 40, 50%, Square, 50+% off of the highs. And they're like, well, no, it's fallen too much right now. I feel like I'm going to catch the dagger. And these are friends, even smart people that work in tech that are maybe think of this as being financially aware, but kind of all across the financially aware investor experience spectrum, which is just so, if you step back and look at that, it's really counterintuitive because it's like, that's like saying this thing that I wanted 3 months ago, that's 40% off. I don't want to buy it now because it might be 60% off.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's still not an amazing deal. And this is where you're learning about dollar cost averaging into something, right? Like investing in something recurring over time is actually sort of a maybe smarter, more theoretically sound way to do it. But we're still so driven by emotions.
That's true. But I think that hyper connection. So if the first thing is the gun shyness, that just makes everyone a little bit more weary of public markets and knowing big bubbles can, I mean, in our lifetime, two big bubbles have happened. And then you add in the hyper connectivity of the Wall Street, of Main Street and hyper connectivity of Wall Street. I think that it supports that. You have potential Fed. This may be so boring for listeners, but hopefully we keep it simple enough to where it's not too in the weeds. But you have these worries of Fed rate hikes, and within 3 months, some tech stocks are down 70%. Like you're saying, 20 to 50% for major blue chip stocks in 3 months. And I wonder if in 3 months they recover because, one, people didn't want to catch the falling dagger. You, in many ways, you know, you buy the rumor, you sell the headline. So you basically, which basically in this scenario would be, you sell the rumor, the Fed rate hikes, and then you buy, if you sell a negative rumor, and then you buy it after the news comes out that, hey, maybe Fed rate hikes aren't that big of a deal. And there was one in, I think, in 94, 96, right before tech takes off. Mm-hmm. And so we see this happen. We see, the actual headline hits. We see it kind of run through in the value chain, and then investors are like, wow, maybe we oversold. So then they buy back. And you see, in 3 months, maybe we see it come back, because here's the underlying substance, in my opinion. Shopify as a business rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Like Airbnb as a business mm-hmm. rocks. The fundamentals of the business.
Absolutely.
Of these businesses.
Yeah.
Square. Still just getting going.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe are they overvalued? Something like Shopify overvalued because mm-hmm. of COVID, and there's a rebalancing, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But do we see the other side of it in 3 months? And we say, wow, that was 6 months where things were gnarly. No one remembers 2016. Mm-hmm. I remember 2016 because we were just about to start fundraising for mm-hmm. Tilt 2016. And then like every board member, every advisor, I was like, not right now.
Oh, no.
And then I watched in 2 weeks everything fall apart in the public markets. And I was like, oh, shit, this is the nuclear winter people are talking. And now no one remembers it.
Yeah,
it's
like I don't remember it. Yeah, that's wild. Yeah.
Anyone interested, just Google LinkedIn stock and look at it in 2016.
No, I'm sure people who were deep at that moment, like you feel like it's like a war scar or something. But then for the rest of us, it's like, well, no right. recollection of that at all.
And I think that could happen for this in this wider market,
mm-hmm.
tech being. And the reason tech is actually, to Sam's question, he's asking about tech. And the answer to your question, in my opinion, Sam, is the fundamentals of the businesses that are the blue chip tech stocks and the up and comers, the recent IPOs that are really great businesses like Zoom, even Peloton, I think, is a great business.
That's a hot take.
Yeah. And I think it's a great business. Like mm-hmm. they shed some of their product lines, like the treadmill. That the love for that product is Apple-esque. But are their operations, is the efficiency Apple-esque? Probably not. But that means it's an investing opportunity. And once it's obvious, all the yield is gone.
Mm-hmm.
But Zoom. Great business. The whole world. I was mentioning this to in an email thread to someone in India, an entrepreneur in India. We can hop on a Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
The whole globe can just use that as
a
noun. It's Kleenex.
Yeah.
And I don't even love the product. The fundamentals of the business of these are really, really strong. So Sam, to your question, I think there is this environmental aspect that is going to deflate these valuations for this period of time. But I think, honestly, tech is where the yield is. If you believe the world is not going to leave products like Zoom,
mm-hmm.
is not going to go back to microsystems over Square,
mm-hmm.
or go back to just
hotels over Airbnb.
Yeah, hotels over Airbnb or big box retail over Shopify.
Yeah. It's a good time to buy, a very good time to buy. And actually, I mean, the luckiest trade I made over the last few weeks was 10 days ago buying Alibaba stock, you know, which has been hit over the past year so hard. It's down, it was down 40, 50 plus percent, I think, because I held some and I held on through all that. But just it went even lower. And I was like, there's no way that this could get worse for Alibaba, because this is an incredible company, right? Mm-hmm. This company has an entire economy that surrounds it and pots up. And then the thing is, it's like, it's going to come back before you can feel it, right? So like mm-hmm. Alibaba bought it, I think it was literally next day or 2 days later, up, I think 30%, 35% wow. in one day. And this is a at a $500 billion company that is going up swinging 30% in a day. I mean, there's always, there's that diagram or that should kind of strike fear in your heart around all the market gains. If you remove 10 days out of a period of multiple years, you can miss out on 50%+ of market gains. Mm. Things crash fast. They also rally fast. And so when things seem relative low, especially great companies, like right now is an amazing time to buy any tech stocks that you actually fundamentally believe in the product and the company. This is when you should be deploying that capital.
Well, I didn't have those numbers to substantiate it because all my investing is early stage. But you want another hot take?
Yes.
Built on that is, I think, knock on wood, but I think the U.S. is going to see, you know, where for all those people in 2017 that were saying we're in the seventh inning, thinking that, you know, it's got to be a 7 to 10 year cycle, so we must be near the end of the ball game. I think we're going to see, so we're 14 years in. Mm-hmm. I actually think we're going to see a 20-year bull run. And it's going to be peppered with these micro recessions. But because of those three fundamental shifts that didn't exist before, the recoveries are going to be much, much faster. A technical recession is 2 quarters in a row with negative growth. Mm-hmm. So it really has to hit past 6 months. And really, a technical recession is GDP based. So GDP dropping for 2 quarters in a row is going to be rare. When you have people that are, it's at incredibly low unemployment that are kind of fearful. Mm-hmm. So great employment numbers and fearful saving, the highest savings rates in recent memory.
Yep.
And this hyper connectivity, I think that we're going to have these dips, but we'll look back. And I think on the other side of this 20-year bull run, maybe 2028, we do see something where history does rhyme and we see a potential collective collapse because we kicked the conversation off with, we are all kind of in this potato sack race together. Mm-hmm. Everybody, every industry's foot in the bag together right now, which is very strange and probably going to have some tectonic downside to it. But I think it's for the foreseeable future, the economy's really strong. Inflation is a fear, but I would take great employment and inflation over the alternatives.
Yep. Over, that makes sense. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, no inflation and you know, unemployment rising. Mm-hmm. So that's my view of what I think will happen. And it'll be us, you know, this whole 7 to 10 year thing.
So we're in the fifth inning.
Yeah, we're in the fifth inning.
Okay.
So go back
just to I need an inning number.
Go back to my friend Clyde.
Yeah.
Tell him we're in the fifth year, fifth inning, and do that. And
okay.
We were in the third inning, I guess, when he was saying
he was so okay. Got it.
But then the last thing
so
on that
2025, we'll be checking in and you'll be like, we're in the seventh inning.
Yeah. Hey, Clyde. We're actually in the seventh inning now, bro. You're done fucked up.
It's like, I haven't talked to you in 13 years.
And he was in wealth management, so he certainly lost me as a...
Good.
No, I'm just kidding. Although it did sound very copy and paste what he was saying at the time, and it did not impress. The counterpoint to the 7 to 10 year thing, by the way, is also 7 to 10 year cycle is Australia's at a 24, maybe 25 year bull run.
Okay.
Before.
Yep.
And they were boosted by growth in Southeast Asia in the same way that might feel anomalous, in the same way that the US economy. And I don't say this with any national, we've chatted about this, nationalism is stupid. I don't say this with any nationalistic pride. I say this with just observational awareness that the U.S. has this crazy, crazy card up its sleeve, which is tech that is globally utilized. Mm-hmm. I mean, every company we've just named that are, many of which
except
are-
Alibaba.
Except for Alibaba, that's right. But so many just happen to be based in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be one of the buoys for this, what I think will be a 20-year bull run is Zoom, Square, even PayPal's been on a run. Stripe's going to go public, Airbnb, obviously Amazon, obviously, you know, all of the FANG companies. Don't agree with me, man.
Yeah.
We actually got that feedback.
I hope you're right. I think I agree in a very theoretical sense. I'm not. I also think the big asset for the U.S. has been the ability to capitalize off of significant advances in manufacturing that are not happening on our soil, right? So sort of globalization more generally, like we have the reserve currency, we have the money, and so we've been able to basically turn China, Taiwan, and other countries into like incredible manufacturing sources for products that we then make the majority of the margin and the profit off of, right? So like that's been huge, and maybe that period at post-COVID is coming, I don't want to say it's coming to an end by any means, but all of a sudden after what's happening in Ukraine, all of a sudden our reliance on Taiwan for literally all the chips and everything from our iPhones to our MacBooks to everything looks a little bit shakier and scarier, right?
That's
and
true.
So I
do you think it looks shakier, or actually do you think it looks safer with China getting to watch the other mouse get smashed going for the cheese with Russia going for Ukraine?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I'm more just thinking the sort of returns that have come from like two markets of globalization might. I think there is going to be a more focus on premise. I mean, like as speaking as someone who runs D2C businesses, some products of which are manufactured abroad and some of which are manufactured here. I've been thanking God every day that the stuff that's manufactured here is manufactured here, because getting any, I mean, supply chain, getting anything from abroad, the costs associated with that, the timelines associated with that have been insane. And
the variables.
You literally cannot make an iPhone in America, right? Mm-hmm. Like we have not set anything up to that point. It is fully like the chips are made in Taiwan. They're assembled, you know, in China. There is this crazy mix of a bunch of different countries and a bunch of materials from many, many countries that need to be like combined to make something like an iPhone. And I do think that people are going to be thinking about ways to move somewhat away from that, from that full reliance on places that are in like areas of especially like nationalistic like concern.
You know? We are all wildly interconnected now in a way that we weren't just even when we were kids. And this is like a 25 year trend that has gone from China, from trinkets to the most valuable devices in all of our lives. Okay, so.
But they make Teslas here.
They do make Teslas here for the, well, they've got the Gigafactory in Berlin and Shanghai now, so.
True.
Maybe they're going to get a lot cheaper and smarter with building them in Shanghai and Berlin. Probably Shanghai. I can't see Germans getting behind an American car company. All right. Now, thank you, Sam, for the question. Next up, we've got a voicemail. You ready?
Ready.
That little ding is the sound of cold, hard, digital, invisible cash going right into your pocket. And by pocket, I mean your digital Shopify account that might be on your phone in your pocket. At least that's the case for us in Magic Mind. Shopify allows you to go from first sale to full scale. And it has for us. Magic Mind has one full-time employee, and we've gotten to 5 million in annualized sales using Shopify. Me, William, amazing GM, and Shopify. It is the no-brainer for any e-commerce stack that you've ever thought of. If you're selling online and you're running into issues left and right, Shopify is a solution. If you're thinking of selling online, it is the dream scenario of being able to get your first sale, scale to millions in sales. And we haven't done this yet, but when we do move into physical retail, when we move into physical shops, start building our own, you can actually go from online with Shopify to offline with Shopify, and everything is in beautiful little dashboard on your phone. I love checking it. You could check it, you know, as you're going to sleep, you just open it up and see your exact sales for the day. You even see tips on how to improve conversion rates, improve your store. Shopify is literally, when I say it's the dream, I mean it. It is the dream. And we've got a special hookup for listeners. So wait for that in a sec. You can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. This is one of my favorite parts about Shopify is it has this ecosystem of thousands of third-party apps, developers, and teams that are building awesome features for the Shopify ecosystem. So you're getting way more than just Shopify. You're getting thousands of applications built to refine the customer experience for all of your customers. We use probably 8 or 9 of these different apps that Shopify doesn't even build, but it's teams building for the Shopify ecosystem. And were we on a different platform, we just wouldn't have access to these thousands of third-party applications to make MagicMind.com so powerful. You gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting on conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/belowtheline, all lowercase, for a 14-day free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. And this is a unique offer for Below the Line. You're going to get something special when you sign up with that slash below the line. So make sure to enter that. It is not offered to everybody. So go to shopify.com/belowtheline, all lowercase. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/belowtheline, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/belowtheline. Today's episode is brought to you by Magic Mind. You've heard it on the podcast before. It is my favorite thing about the morning is when I get to take my Magic Mind 12 magical ingredients that get you into flow state. It is, as Forbes put it, Silicon Valley's new morning elixir for so many reasons. It is, but for me, I'll just say the fact that I get dialed in, not amped up like an energy drink, but dialed into my work so quickly. It is basically just motivation, focus, energy, and de-stressing in a bottle. It's really, truly magical. Go to magicmind.co, magicmind.co, enter promo code BTL for below the line, BTL, to get 20% off of your first order and see if it works for you. You can literally tweet at Magic Mind, say whatever you didn't like about it, and you get a free refund. It is so easy to get a refund if you do not dig it. So there's really no reason to not try it and see if it is magical for you. You can go to magicmind.co/love just to see all of the public praise. Pete Holmes, the famous comedian, he doesn't stop tweeting about how magical Magic Mind is for him. So you'll probably see that if you look it up on Twitter. But if you've never tried it, go order it. It's promo code BTL for below the line to get 20% off. And again, you get a free it's easy refund if you don't dig it. MagicMind.co and start making magic.
Hey, James. This is William in Dallas, Texas.
William? D-Town? DTX? How are we doing?
That was DFW.
What is the one piece of advice that has meant more and more to you over time in your career than any other piece of advice? Thanks and love the podcast.
All right. So what is one piece of advice that has meant more and more? You say more and more. Sorry, I talked over for a second, William. That's my bad.
What is the one piece of advice that has meant more and more to you over time in your career than any other piece of advice? Thanks and love the podcast.
We gotta unpause and love
the podcast.
I think there's a little extra. Okay, what is one piece of?
Thank you.
What's one piece of advice? I just went on a rant. Okay. So I want to hear you.
Yeah. Thank you, Will. William. The one that I return to the most in terms of like when I'm giving other people career advice, friends, my girlfriend, whatever, whoever it is, that I got when I was younger, which has always rung very true to me is, but I didn't really understand why until later, is when you join any job and generally this is like when you're working for an organization or you're like, you have a more traditional job where you have like a boss. It's not exactly like you starting a company or something like that. It could be actually if you have investors in that company who are on your board and so on. But when you're plugging into some organization, there's always going to be a period at the beginning where, or hopefully if you sign up for the right job, there's going to be a period at the beginning, and it could be a long lasting period, where you're gaining more from the opportunity and the job, and you're learning more than they're learning. You have to be trained into the organization. You have to be, say you're starting something that like is at the tip end of your skills, or maybe even further beyond that. You have to learn up, train up, learn a ton about a new company, a new product, whatever it is. And sort of gain skills and learn really rapidly. You know, in the first couple weeks, couple months of a job, you're learning super rapidly. In the first couple years, you're executing and you're really like just learning a ton. And then there is a point at which that switches over and the organization is getting more value from you being there and you going in every day than you're getting from it, right? And that's just the nature of how, as a company owner, recruiting works, right? You have to say, I'm going to invest in James as a new team member of ours. And James is going to spend the first 6 months ramping up, or the first year ramping up. He's going to learn. We're going to teach him all this stuff. And then from year two onwards, you know, or year one onwards, he's going to be like this machine for us that just crushes it, writes all the code that we need to be written, is doing a great job. And, you know, in a very kind of capitalist theoretical sense, like we pay James $150K a year and we're getting $300K of value out of him for the code that he writes. Like no one's actually doing those calculations, but that is how the organization has to work for it to ultimately be profit making, right? Mm-hmm. When people look at numbers like revenue of company divided by the total number of employees or whatever, right? So that's been really interesting. I think it's an interesting way to evaluate, should I stay at this job or should I leave? It's like, is this job now taking more from me being here and benefiting more from me being here than I am actually benefiting from being here? Which direction is that value transfer going in? And as soon as you, the advice that I had gotten was, as soon as you feel that value transfer start to switch, that's when you move to the next thing. So being self-interested in a way.
That's so selfish.
Yeah, it is, but that's how we have to be in careers, I think.
I totally disagree.
You completely disagree with that?
Completely disagree.
Let's hear it.
Well, think about it. The other way around would be like, oh, Ajay's getting more out of this role than we are as a company, and it's 4 days in, 8 days in. Sorry, man. Gotta go. You got to leave. Like, imagine if the company operated that way.
Well, that's exactly it, right? I think that the employee has to, an employer as a person, you have to look out for your best interests and where you're going to learn the most. And if you are in a situation now where you're learning less and the company is basically like squeezing you out for the value that you additionally have, but you're not learning fast, that's how you know it's time to do something else.
What if they gave you a year to ramp up and there is at least some mutual benefit of, okay, we're going to invest in you for a year so that we get something on the other side.
It's a tough one, man.
That psychology would be, all right, they invested in me a year. I got everything I needed. I'm out.
It's a tough one. I think obviously that it's not a totally one-way value transfer. You're still contributing, like as you're training up or whatever it is. But yeah, life is somewhat short and we all like want to be accomplishing and learning and doing more. And I do think that there's something to not like when it's at a point where you're getting squeezed for your value and you're not actually improving or learning, you should probably in a somewhat self-interested way go to a place where you're going to keep learning. So maybe that is a disagreement between us.
Well, I think it definitely is a disagreement between us. I don't know how strongly I feel, but it's certainly a quick knee-jerk reaction of, man, that sounds like a short-term thinking where you get four jobs in after 8 years and there's, it's hard to say, okay, leave that fourth.
I think the variable here that I missed in my explanation of this was that period could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be 20 years. So it's like, how do you turn a job into something where you're growing fast, you're continuing to learn a lot, and you're not at a point where you're like writing code that is boring / rote for you, and you're the person on the other side of that is gaining a lot more from you writing that code than you are learning from doing it. You can I'm not at all saying don't be loyal to your company, to your job, and so on. That's important, but only to the extent that you're still learning, developing, benefiting from being there.
Yeah, no, and I'm not saying no one should pledge blind loyalty to a company, but to the manager that took a chance on someone that isn't maybe is going to be an investment. Then for that person to then say, thanks, I got what I, it would be like leaving your parents. Being like, hey, good luck, y'all, but you're going to have to figure out geriatric care because it's I'm not, I kind of need, I'm interested in other things. And I learned all, I got all I got that, that I was looking to get out of this. And I, that's obviously a caricature, but I feel like in general, there's this overemphasis on rights versus duties in general in our current society, where it's like, what do I get? How do I benefit? Instead of an emphasis on like, an emphasis on what do I owe? Mm-hmm. Where can I help? Where can I be useful? I feel like that psychology of that career of like, how do I climb the ladder and siphon value? I'm using the most negative terms. I understand that. But how do I siphon value from these organizations? People will just feel it and see that.
So I think it's actually, yeah. So I'm looking at it from the other perspective where it's like, it's the organization is siphoning value. And so it's more like, frankly, like the balance, and I feel personally that the balance in our society is way less a person has a duty to their company, which they do. You're totally right. And it's much more so that the company or an organization that manages or employs people is often way under utilizing the duty that they maybe have to their team and to their employees to compensate them well, to keep them interested, to keep them doing interesting work, to keep like investing in them and developing them. You know, I often feel like the way it plays out is way less on the sort of individuals being a mercenary type side and way more on the company not treating its employees very well side. Is there's a siphoning of value on both sides, and I would rather the individual optimize for themselves and their self-development than optimizing for a company that as soon as the time comes time for layoffs, like they're gone anyways, right? Where's the duty there, right?
I think if someone operates each day of like, what's my duty? Where can I be useful? They're the last to ever get laid off. I think if someone is doing the scoreboard tracking of, okay, am I at the point where I should leave? Am I at the point where I've gotten? Those are the first to get laid off. The ones always grabbing coffee, learning about the other roles, that feeling like, well, the last three jobs have only been a year and a half, 2 years. So it's been about a year. So I should start having coffee. I should start thinking about those are the first to get laid off. Versus the ones, I mean, I think about some of the core people at Airbnb at 5,000 people that truly were, it was like, man, this person takes on the shittiest jobs. Mm-hmm. And I can't believe they're going after that. That's going to be so hard, whatever it is, like getting XYZ ready for the IPO, getting payment taxes across borders, getting those somehow, you know, coordinating something gnarly. And I would see these amazing people go after it, just like running into the burning building type.
Well, that's
of
wonderful. Solving hard problems is wonderful. And that sounds like they've kept their jobs interesting and hopefully they're being rewarded. It sounds like in these cases, they've been really rewarded well by Airbnb for doing that. And so if the reward is there, the learning is there, like 100%.
Yeah. And okay. So that's great. That is a great piece of advice, I think, for anyone that's thinking through that exchange. I think it's, I'm glad you brought it up. That is a definite, that is internal dialogue for 90% of probably employees at companies and people listening to this podcast. I maybe would add the addendum of make sure that you've at least repaid the debt that the company has.
Sure. I think that's fair. Yeah.
Has given you. And then after that, when you feel like, okay, now I'm going into the red here, then it's time to leave. But at the end of the day, ball don't lie.
True. True.
All right. So next up, or actually I should answer mine. Best piece of advice that I ever got that I think about over and over and over again is so simple. And it has nothing to do with a mentor business leader telling me anything. It was actually a sleep doctor telling me, wake up every morning at the exact same time. Hands down, the piece of advice that I think about year over year, I probably heard it 9 years ago when I was 26.
No matter when you went to sleep.
No, it doesn't matter when you go to sleep, but wake up every morning at the exact same time so that it sets
some kind of circadian rhythm type thing.
It sets your 24-hour circadian rhythm to where your biological, your hormonal clock is set every day. And after 9 days, you don't need an alarm clock anymore. And your body is just in a groove. 30 minutes after you wake up, it's not struggling to figure out what time it is, you know, 3 hours after waking up. And you're in a groove in 30 minutes. Within 2 hours of waking up, you've already knocked off some really important tasks. Mm-hmm. And within the first half of the day, you felt like you already won the day instead of being disoriented for 3 or 4 hours and it becoming, you know, it's noon, it's one, it's two, and you feel like, what did I do today? So that's the best piece of advice. There's a great question, William, because that one specifically.
That is good advice.
Gets, you know, yeah. to that, like, what do I think more and more? Mm-hmm. Year after year. Mm. I think about that stupidly simple piece of advice that a sleep doctor told me when I was struggling with sleeping. And yeah, it did end up setting the time that I went to bed pretty consistently, but it was through just being like
having to wake up at the same time that led you to. So what's your time?
Right now, it's 5.
5, wow.
So right now, which I was a total night owl, but then 2 kids growing older and then loving feeling good in the morning. It ended up cascading into like all these things, getting to bed early, waking up early before the rest of the world's woken up. I've gotten 2 hours. I hit inbox zero today by 7.
Wow.
It worked out.
So you work first thing. You wake up and you go right to work?
No, I wake up, I do an hour of spiritual study and then an hour of journaling, spiritual reflection. So 2 hours of spiritual study, and today just had 10 minutes of
Okay. So inbox. You just didn't have like a ton of email. Okay.
No, I didn't have a ton. And I was like, and it is rare to get to inbox zero by 7, but, and today I woke up at 4:17 to be exact.
Wow.
Magic Mind was doing overtime. I just felt well rested and woke up at 4:17. I was like, all right, I'm ready to go.
You just woke up and looked at the clock and you're like, it's 4:17. I'm awake now.
Yeah, I'm awake now. And
you weren't tired.
We're recording this at 3:47, a little bit, but I took a Magic Mind.
I meant more at the time of waking up. That's my main issue. Because I tried, my alarm's set for 7:30. I try to get up between 7:30 and 8 every day, but I'm tired. I'm like, I got to get up. I'm tired. It's not like I'm like bouncing out of bed every morning or something.
Okay, so I was a little tired at 4:17, but I wasn't fatigued, but I was like, I guess I could sleep till 5.
Uh-huh.
But I mentioned that because there's this Rumi quote that I heard yesterday that goes something like, the breeze at dawn has secrets to tell you. Don't go back to sleep. And so I thought about that yesterday when I heard that. I was like, the breeze at dawn has secrets.
There's something very true to that. Just, and I know some people are morning or night people. I know that's a whole thing.
I was a total night person. I'm 23andMe says that I'm a total night owl.
And me too, for sure, historically. But there is just something, maybe it's because I had less exposure to it, not being a morning person for so many years. But like, there is something about like sitting down, even in front of a blank document, a tough creative challenge, maybe at work, something that you're just sitting down there at. You know, let's not make it crazy early. Let's just say at 8:30, right? Mm-hmm. At 8. But you're like starting your day more fresh-minded after waking up, after doing your morning routine and then starting there. Like, it is so much easier to actually like complete interesting creative thought than it is if you try to do it at 2 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
or at 5 p.m. There's just something about the fresh mind that doesn't have the accumulated cruft of the day.
Yeah, exactly. So I felt that intuitional truth to that Rumi quote. And then I said, okay, the breeze of dawn has some secrets. Mm-hmm. So it's 4:17 and I could just, and it was a little cold, which is always beckons me to like stay in bed until 5 when I really can't sleep beyond it. So then I was like, it's a little cold.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, oh, the second line is don't go back to sleep.
Mm.
Okay, I'll get up.
So you're that guy when people are like, top tip for most powerful CEO investor moguls. It's like, wake up every day at 4:30 a.m. hit the treadmill for an hour or whatever. You're that guy. You're the actual guy that's waking up at that time. Yeah.
Ronald Reagan used to say that, and he got dementia. So no, prioritize sleep. really prioritize sleep and get, you know, 7-8 hours, which is what it's so great with kids, because it's just a constraint. You got to be at home chilling, kind of winding down at like 7:30.
Yeah, you're not at the bar or whatever. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
but it has been,
or maybe you are.
It has been,
and you're not a great dad.
You were going to dinner tonight. Might be a late night tonight, but there's certainly been a shift in quality of life by waking up every morning at the same time. I think when that's I first awesome. Heard that at 26, I think I'd made it like 8:15 or something. Because you have to do some mental calculus of when you're going to wake up in betwixt your late nights, your Saturday, Sundays, when you want to sleep a little extra. So it was like 8:15. And then it was like 8, then 7:45, 7:30. At 5, that it is truly... it is incalculable how powerful it is to, like, it's 8, 9, maybe 10, and you've knocked out the most important thing you wanted to do that day.
Yeah, that's amazing. That you must just feel on top of the world for the rest of the day. Totally. Yeah.
House money after that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, next and last voicemail.
Great voicemail. All right.
This episode is also brought to you by ChargeBee. Imagine this. You're launching your subscription product and you need to invoice your first few customers. You integrate with a payment gateway, write some code to support recurring billing, and you start charging things up. Stuff seems to work until you need to create tax compliant invoices or set up flexible trials and run pricing experiments. Yikes. Or integrate with more than one gateway. Yoinks! Billing needs grow as business needs grow. Every line of code you write for your billing system contributes to the spaghetti nightmare that will keep you away from your core product. Don't do that. ChargeBee is here to help. We replace in-house billing systems and spreadsheets by giving teams the ability to set up subscription plans and trials, run pricing experiments at scale, analyze accurate subscription analytics, accept multiple payment methods, and much, much more right out of the box. ChargeBee works with global payment gateways like Stripe, Braintree, PayPal, everybody, and integrates with essential tools like HubSpot, Baremetrics, Xero, QuickBooks, Salesforce, and much more. ChargeBee, ChargeBee, ChargeBee. The journey to the first million is often the hardest. To help you get there faster, we're offering free access to ChargeBee's Rise plan. This offer is valid until you hit your first million dollars in revenue. This is a meeting that goes back 2 weeks ago. Me and the CEO, I said, this isn't enough at 500K. This isn't enough at 750. This offer should be valid until customers hit their first million in revenue. And that's how we came to this decision. So you don't have to worry about billing and subscription management in the marathon that is running your business. To avail the services, love that. I'm going to start using that phrase as often as possible. To avail the services, sign up for a ChargeBee account with the link in our show notes for chargebee.com/partners. Sign up and enter your details with the coupon code BTL for below the line BTL. And then you complete your sign up within seconds. Super easy. ChargeBee rock.
Hey, James. This is Mike in the Bay Area.
Mike, in the Bay Area, our old stomping G's.
My question is, Peter Thiel has an interview question that goes something like, what is something you believe that no one else you know believes? Just interested in how you would answer. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. The Bay Area, what is something you believe that no one else you know?
We got Peter Thiel influencing the pod now.
Man, his... Yeah, and that question, you've heard that question before,
I've
right?
heard that, yeah.
Yeah, that is a famous question he's known for. What is something you believe, to, I guess, gauge your independent thinking?
Yep.
What is something, Ajay, that you believe that no one else you know believes, obviously? Planet of 8 billion people. Something you believe none of your friends believe. Sorry to put you on the spot.
I know, this is on the spot one. This is a tough one. You want to go first?
I can go first only because I have asked people this, or when it was, I think it was in vogue in like 2015 or 2016.
Okay.
I remember having to think, oh, wow, would I answer that?
Yep.
And something that I've thought about in the last 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a recurring question.
Mm-hmm.
Something I've thought about in the last 6 months that I think is, I haven't heard anyone say personally, is I think nearly everyone is going to move towards freelancing.
Mm.
And it might have a cool title like consultant, part-time CMO.
Consultant being a cool title is always surprising to me, but
yeah,
it's like,
yeah, you worked at McKinsey before.
Yeah, or I mean, just who? I mean, I work with a lot of freelancers, but it's like, I don't, people think it's cool to be a consultant. Is that,
yeah,
that's new.
Yeah. As it has some cachet, but that's what I think, and I'm talking like an extreme number,
mm-hmm.
like 70% of people in 20 years will be freelancers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't say yeah if you don't believe
it. No, I completely agree with that one. So
oh,
I don't
really?
Even know if that would. Yeah, oh. Yeah. Well, just because that's how I run my business, too. We have a bunch of freelancers and contractors and consultants that we work with. And so it's like someone that is great at doing at sending out great emails, but does it for four clients, and that's their full time job, right? Of collection of four part time jobs. So I mean, that one makes sense to me.
For the feedback, for the person that we both know that said they wanted more Discord.
Yeah.
Sorry. Might not find it here, and we're not going to make it up. Yeah, so I think, and for someone that's a lawyer in Chicago, wondering how that will work, there's going to be a day in the next 4 years for that lawyer's life where they're going to hear from a friend that left the big white shoe law firm that is now making more money on their own schedule, or at least making comparable money on their own schedule from home without any corporate artifice and bullshit, that will be, you know, at lunch raving about how they're practicing law. And then 4 weeks later, you're going to think about it, and there's going to be some cool, hip marketplace online, there probably already is, where you can estimate in 2026 how much you would make. And you'd fantasize about spending more time with your kids before you go from, I'm a partner at so-and-so, there's no way I'd leave, I've spent 18 years to get here, to 4 years from now. Goes from an idea that your friend is implementing to a choice for you and your family 5 months later.
I'm gonna fade you on this one. We're gonna create some disagreement.
All right.
All right.
This is that is, what
I'm gonna,
fade
I'm
means?
I'm gonna teal you.
Is that what fade means?
It means like bet against.
Oh, okay.
I'm gonna teal you though. Maybe that's a better way to say it. Contrarian you. Right. So 100%. What you're describing is something that is playing out today. I wonder actually if once we get through the full cycle of this playing out, which could take, in depending on industry, 5 to 10 to 20 years. If we will actually revert to that being far less, not the norm, maybe it will be the norm, but far less the norm than people maybe think. So fewer than 50% of people doing it if we think it's going to stretch up to 70 or 80 or something like that. Reasoning is, I think you're already seeing it happen in some industries. So like when you were saying all that, I was thinking of Substack. Substack is like, you know, journalists work at legacy media publications or whatever, wherever they can write. Maybe they're just bloggers, independent bloggers. Substack comes out. All of a sudden, someone realizes they can leave their job at the New York Times or Vox or whatever, earn crazy multiples amounts of money over what they would have earned as a reporter at a website like Vox. And then they, you know, they like work for their own schedule. They release a few blogs a week. They're making tons of money. It's like this amazing thing. So everyone in traditional media is like, I want that. I want to do that. But I think there will be, especially in something like media, there's this weird power law thing that emerges, right? Where probably for a couple writers and for a, say, call it 5-10% of the writers that are that have an audience that can bring it with them and so on, it's a great decision. And then for 90%+, it's a terrible decision. Actually having the infrastructure of a traditional media, getting paid a salary, not having to build that audience completely up on your own, is actually like better for them, frankly, than like having the institutional support is better than what it would be like if they were going on their own. I think we also see this with, it's funny because I know a lot of people who are taking on this new, I'm a freelancer now, not having a job. And I think for some people, I think everyone wants to be their own boss, right? And some of that is you starting a company. Some of that could be you starting an agency, right? That employs just yourself and a few people. Some of it could be you starting your own independent law firm like you're referring to. But I think that like you, we're not because people want to be their own boss so badly, they're not factoring in all the things that being part of a law firm actually gives you, which is that you don't need to go and spear all your own fish, right? You don't need to go catch all your own clients. You don't need to like constantly manage them all the time. You're not going to be up to, you're not going to have to deal with the vagaries and the ups and downs of, oh, you know, it's March and none of my clients have booked any work with me. Like, I need to go sell some more work, right? Being at a law firm, you just get the work because it comes in. So I wonder if, I think everyone's going in this direction. And then I think we're going to see like a good chunk of even maybe the people that we know that have taken that path being like, I did it for 5 years and like, it was cool to be my own boss, I guess, but I was way more stressed out and I actually ended up making less money. And now I'm joining LLP, whatever, you know, whatever law firm.
Maybe, but to teal your teal, I actually think it's, I think we're going to solve a lot of the frictional problems for those individuals. And it's, if something like Airbnb can allow you to list your empty bedroom and get visibility based on simple but powerful things like review systems, a destination to search for these things, where you get to be part of Airbnb, but you get to do it on your own terms. You would get to be part of a marketplace, for example. I found a great designer on Upwork. I found two or three, but one that's fantastic. And it was really easy. It was the same service. I copy and pasted what I'd used for the previous designer. And that person now has too much work for even me to get them back.
Mm-hmm. Got to be careful. Yeah, I know. Hold your designers close.
I know. I try to give them 1-star reviews over and over again so that no one would go for his services. But that's so, I think things will pop up to bridge the gap and provide ultimate flexibility while giving these people still some great awareness. Where I do think it will have friction is that it seems great to everyone freelance and everyone use these online services to promote their own business until they start competing with the designer in Pakistan that's willing to work for 1/5 the price.
Mm.
And they're living in the San Francisco loft.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, wait a second. In 2023, I was making a killing on Upwork or I'm sure they're designed specific one, TopTal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they wake up in 2026 and they're like, oh, wow, this has actually given birth to 10 times the competition. So that will be a major frictional point. And maybe it could unwind my argument to where I don't know what you do in that scenario, because this scenario would be, it's working well, but it's working so well.
You got to create guilds of overcompensated Americans that are doing poor work than their Pakistani counterparts, and then just got to pay them some kind of basic income. Maybe they get the work from the government or something. I don't know, man. The future in that sense is, I don't know if bleak is the right word, because it's great for the independent Pakistani guy, but
and it's great for the consumer. It's
great for the consumer, but it's not great for the
creator.
Over credentialed, maybe less talented and slower and kind of fat and happy, Western or American sort of creator.
Yeah, it's where they will be geolocationally protected as services.
Mm-hmm.
So handymen are going to be, especially in this COVID and post-COVID world, great handy people
mm-hmm.
are going to be swimming in cash because mm-hmm. everyone's improving their homes.
Mm-hmm.
If there was, I'm sure there is a platform. I don't know of a platform to find a great handy man or woman, but in text threads with friends, mm-hmm. when you find a good one, you really don't want people to know because it is so, so hard to find a good one and they're always booked out. So in services, there's probably, technical trades. It's going to be phenomenal just to see reviews of technicians
mm-hmm.
and for people to know like, hey, I'm a great electrician. I don't need to be part of Santa Monica Electrician Company. I can just go do it on my own as a freelancer. Same for plumbing, same for a lot of these trades. It'll be a godsend for the talented individual that doesn't want to deal with just being an hourly employee.
Mm-hmm.
But that's mine. What is yours?
I can't just take my tealing of your tealing there. As,
yeah, well, once it's kind of like pogs. Once you have been teal, your teal has been tealed, it's time to move on to your answer for the question. No, you can respond if you want.
Yeah. No, no, no. I'll just, mine might be just a corollary to what we were just talking about, which I think is more true than than people realize and is going to have a pretty massive impact on like how things play out over the coming decades, which is that I think that like what we might consider to be like safe, high intellect jobs that require a lot of credentialing in some cases, or don't even, everything from programmer to lawyer to working in finance to doctor.
I'll see someone on a screen in Mumbai.
I wasn't even going to say
$5.
So that, 100% I agree with that. So that's like step one. And then step 10 is like those jobs and the sort of like financial arbitrage maybe that's considered as part of those jobs and so on is going to be the first that's lost to like increasing sophisticated AI and robotics and like so on, right? So like actually like the independent handyman guy is not going to be able to be replaced by a robot for a very long time, but already, if you're like a JD and you're graduating from Harvard Law School next year, I would be pretty worried about what your job looks like in 2050 or 2040 or even earlier, maybe.
For the surgeon that's just finishing their residency at Stanford and 10 years. There's the great Bill Gates quote of we overestimate what will happen in a year and underestimate what will happen in 10.
Yeah, sorry, 2050 was way too far out. 2035.
Yeah, could be.
Okay, that was my corollary to that point, but here's another one, I guess. So the far and away standard issue advice in Silicon Valley is that ideas are cheap and execution is everything. Talk is cheap. Ideas are cheap and execution is everything. As my last couple of companies have played out and I've been party and witness to investing in companies and seeing what's working and what's not, it actually is my belief from thinking that ideas are 5 to 10% of something and execution is 90 to 95% has been gradually shifting the other way over time.
Oh, really?
To the extent of me now thinking that like, and it really depends on the idea and the market for sure, but at this point I would be with the vast majority of cases, actually like idea, so product and what and the specific viewpoint on the world that you have with the product that you're introducing into the market at that right time is actually way more important than people in Silicon Valley give it credit for. I think the standard issue advice is like pick a big market, have talented founders and go attack it. And the idea is there, it's the talented founders will be able to execute the best, but it's actually not that. It's like the true talented founders are able to pick out what are the right ideas to pursue as solutions and products in that market that then help them execute. And unfortunately, I mean, it's kind of one of the reasons why, as much as I love so much my friends that are super talented engineers, I think being able to engineer a solution to a problem doesn't mean that you're picking the right problem to solve and also that you're picking the right solution to attack the problem. And that's why I think that sometimes, frankly, like to say this in maybe a more harsh way that I could be challenged on for sure, but like artists or creatives can sometimes come up with better, sharp ideas than engineers can.
Yeah.
And the engineers that are coming up with amazing startup ideas and amazing startups and amazing businesses are the ones that are thinking more like artists than that are thinking like, how do I engineer a solution to this problem?
That's interesting. And everyone's heard at least a lot of people in our friend, and that's the question is, something that you believe that others around you don't. And our friend group certainly it's like, who cares about the idea? Tell everybody, get advice on it, get feedback.
And that might not be as good advice.
Fundraise from 30 people. And
yeah.
And what you're saying is that actually maybe now more than ever in this trend line, is ideas are going to be far more valuable than before.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because it's become so, it's a lot easier to build out the idea? It's never been easier to start something today. Mm-hmm. That there is this compromise quality, like that it is much more about the key insight that you have than the perseverance and the perspiration, as they say. That was the case 10 years ago.
I think it might be a part of it, but I think that even 10 years ago or even 8 years ago, the reason that Walt Disney was able to create the best cartoons isn't because he did have talented animators, but there were other people doing animation at the same time. It was because he lived in the future of what animation could become, of how sound was going to be married with visuals, of how, like, you know, in a sense, as an animator, he was an engineer of his time as well. But the thing that made it incredible was that he was an artist, or maybe not even in the classic sense of an artist, he was a visionary that could like see where things would be going and what the existing technology would be able to produce, and then made that and made the future. And so I think that we don't give enough. It's weird because look, we worship Steve Jobs and people like that. We don't give enough credit to actually like what made them successful, which wasn't having the best execution. It was having the best ideas.
Mm. Yeah, it wasn't even building the thing. It was understanding how big that thing could be, like Steve Wozniak and the Apple One and a personal computer. And that was certainly, I mean, like the graphical user interface, there were hundreds of engineers that saw it, but not that many that saw the potential for it. That's interesting that the future may, at least the next few chapters of the future, might rest more in the artist.
It's good insight. News for artists.
Yeah, that is definitely good news for artists. And it was,
or creative minds, I guess you could say. And very, those definitely include engineers as well, but not all.
Very different than when we were interviewing for Y Combinator in 2011. Facebook was about to go public. When we were in YC, it went public.
Mm-hmm.
$100 billion company. And it was, let's find 20-year-old hoodie wearing engineers.
Yep.
That have little to no charisma, but and little to no poetic sense of where the future is going, but have built something with a graph going up and to the right, and you know, some massive scale. That example is kind of a great example because all of the investors are looking for those types of founders. And you and I probably wore, I wore hoodies to every investor meeting. Total,
for sure.
Total, you know, parrot of like, okay,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I like a hoodie as good as anyone, but
you made hoodies.
Yeah, we made a bunch of them, but there was they were great. Well, it's really shout out to American Apparel, but there's something to everyone parroting and just speaking to, this is what sells. Okay. But yeah, that's interesting. That is Facebook is a perfect example because that engineer and Mark Zuckerberg didn't even get the idea. It wasn't his idea.
Mm. You believe that? I think you're probably right, but
no, yeah, I don't, yeah, yeah, I don't think it was. I mean, they settled the lawsuit. Apparently, apparently they got Winklevoss.
Twins
got 60 million.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think things will change. I think that like already the ethos in like crypto as the next kind of like emerging / already arrived, but very quickly growing kind of layer of the startup sector is already, I mean, as the killer app of the last year of crypto NFTs show, it is like the dialogue is almost centered around artists and creative ways to use what is a still somewhat new technology. So I think things are changing. I think that like...
That is interesting. Yeah. Crypto is a good a window into this world you're talking about, in that it has existed for, at that point, existed for 12 years, and a lot of engineers needed artists to build killer apps, quote unquote, to build something that people wanted to use the blockchain for, and it was NFTs in that incarnation. Facebook is still also a good example in that Mark has, and that leadership team has never built an innovative product beyond their first app, Facebook, which I do believe, yeah, that he didn't come up with the idea. I think that is standard. I thought that was standard history, but maybe mm-hmm. maybe I'm reading too much into it. But certainly what has been well documented and observable from the front row is Facebook has never come up with anything innovative beyond the first product. Every massive business that they have was an acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have tried to do
things. Or a stolen feature story.
Right. Yeah. Stolen feature within. Yeah. Instagram. But Instagram, WhatsApp, these two massive behemoths that are the next chapter of Oculus, I guess, if you believe in VR. But
I do think it's true. I hate to hate on Zuck or Ben because I have an immense amount of respect for like what they built, what they're doing, and so on. But like when you hear him talk about it, it all does feel like post rationalizations on something that became very successful and was clearly like an opportunity at the time that he was doing it, an opportunity in social networking that then he talks about how his life mission is to help people connect and stuff. And it's like, was that really your life? You were 18. You know, you were.
When it was at 100,000 users, they were fundraising for a Dropbox-like file sharing site called Wirehog.
Okay, yeah.
And they couldn't raise funding for it.
Yep.
And then it went from 100,000 to 200,000 in 60 days.
Like, and they're like, new life mission unlocked.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's a really interesting take about the future being up for grabs for artists more so than at least within the technological startup realm, right brain thinkers, perhaps more so than the engineering how to. Interesting. Well, that was another thank you so much for the listeners that called in. It was another great episode on voicemails, and for those that tweeted at us at Go Below the Line and call us at 424-272-6640. 424-272-6640.
Boom.
We would love to hear from you. Any questions you have on anything regarding any of the topics we covered today or anything regarding tech, the psychology of creation, the inner journey of creation. And we didn't get to any of the deep. Well, we open it up with a question that thank you for sharing how you felt about your lowest moment or the scariest moment in the recent months. It is a scary time when it feels like the world is on the precipice of shifting in like three different directions mm-hmm, right now, which mm-hmm. certainly is how it feels. But, something that I had a heart condition and mm-hmm. this heart doctor, very dry guy, very dry Syrian doctor, mm-hmm. beautiful man,
mm-hmm.
but would never crack a smile.
Physically beautiful man.
Yeah.
He was very handsome.
Soul.
Okay.
He actually was... I think he smoked a lot,
which
is weird for your heart doctor to feel like he's ripping cigs in between appointments. But I something he said to me that I'll never forget is I went and set up an appointment like 6 months after I was diagnosed mm-hmm. with a heart condition, set up an appointment with him. And I said, feel like I'm back in irregular heartbeat. And he goes, okay, well, let's run the test. And they ran the test. And he comes back. Run the test. He comes back in 15 minutes later. He's like, well, everything's looking great.
Hmm.
I said, but I feel like I'm in irregular rhythm. And he goes, I get that you feel that way, but that's not how it is. And he said it so dry, so.
Wow. I love that.
So.
Seeking truth.
Metaphorically. Yeah, it was so deep. Freaking hit me like a ton of bricks. And I think about that all the time.
Wow.
So, maybe it feels this way, but that doesn't mean that's how it is.
Wow, wow, wow. No, that's what we're all doing, seeking truth.
Amen, amen. And if you are a listener that wants to seek truth on a question you have, hit us up. We'd love to answer it. And maybe we'll do a live call soon.
That would be amazing. We should totally do that, yeah.
We could get, a previous guest, Justin Kahn from Twitch.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Has a new company that's actually building on what we were just talking about.
Oh, so cool.
As you were talking, I was thinking to myself, you know who would have a good answer on where the world is heading, or at least a good, much better contribution than mine to the topic you brought up would be him. So maybe
that'd be amazing. I mean, yeah, I don't know much about what he's working on. I would love to hear about that.
It's really cool.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Really cool marketplace, NFT marketplace that I think a lot of NFT stuff is bunk. Mm. But then there's going to be you know, in the midst of the pets.com and the web vans, there's going to be Amazons and massive businesses built in what I think is an NFT bubble that I think we've chatted about before. Mm-hmm. But there is some really substantial shifts that are happening. So until
let's
next
do that.
Time.
Let's do that. Send in your questions. Always fun. Yeah.
Always fun, Ajay. Until next time, everybody. This has been another episode of Below the Line.